Hello, my friends. Welcome back to the What If Project podcast. My name is Glenn, and this is episode 287 of the show. We are in the middle of, it feels like a series of conversations. Back in the day, if you've been around the What If Project for a while, you remember that I used to do a lot of series. I came out of the church world where I was always preaching, and we always had like a sermon series, you know? And so I had that like mindset with the podcast, like, oh, it'd be cool to like redeem that, because that was one of the things I loved about being a pastor was creating sermons and talks every week and being able to deliver them and having like a theme, you know, and all that kind of stuff. I love that. So I brought that vibe to the podcast and it was fun for a while. I might do it again. But we did like one on the Bible. It was called Setting the Bible Free. It didn't cause any trouble. Another one was, I remember, Lies We Believe About God. Also didn't cause any trouble. We did one on hell. We did one on, Women's Voices You Need to Hear, where I brought on like all these amazing women and we talked to them. And yeah, it was fun, but this feels like these conversations we're having now, we're going to be having the upcoming weeks, are about grief. And because my father passed away March 5th of 2023. And so this month marks a year since he's been gone. And I don't know. It's hard. It was hard to start talking about it in a deep, vulnerable way on the podcast, because I've mentioned it obviously on the podcast, but to have conversations revolving around grief. I had some of these conversations scheduled to record like last fall, like September, October, and I couldn't do it. And thankfully, I mean, the people who I had the conversations with are very gracious, and they were very willing to push things back, because I can remember one person in particular. I woke up in the morning, we're supposed to have a conversation. It was like 2 hours from the time I got up. And I was like, I definitely can't do this today. I definitely cannot have a conversation about grief and my father, because I feel like I'm going to erupt into tears at any moment. And so have all been very gracious. And yeah, but some of these conversations are deep, you know. Rob Bell last week we talked about a lot of things, but it was a very, I don't know if you got the vibe on the recording, but when we were talking, recording aside, it felt like a very intimate moment of sharing about our dads. Today we're talking to Elaine Pagels. Elaine is someone, she's been on the show two or three other times, but she's one of the people who has become a friend to me over the years. Someone who I actually email once in a while just to say hi kind of thing. And when my father passed away, like literally the day after, she was one of the first people I reached out to. She wrote a book called Why Religion. This book is her memoir. She's going to talk about it in this episode. But a lot of people don't know about Elaine is that her 6-year-old son, I don't remember the year. It was a while ago, a long time ago. Her 6-year-old son had a very rare illness and passed away. And then a year later, her husband passed away. And so if anybody knows and is familiar with grief, and who I feel has the right to, or the authority, maybe, I don't know what the right word is, but to speak into it, to stick their finger in the conversation of grief and swirl the waters a little bit, to give us some unique perspective, it's Elaine. She's one of the reasons why I reached out. It's one of the reasons why I reached out to her last year, is because I knew she would have some words of wisdom, you know, to share. And the funny thing is that she really didn't. She didn't really say anything, and you'll hear in this episode why. But she just really offered her presence, you know, like There's really no words. I'm just here. And sometimes when you're in the midst of grief, that's really all you need to hear. And so anyway, in this episode, I don't know if you'll get the vibe in the recording, but there were times where we both had tears in our eyes, you know, as we were talking and just really sharing things. And Elaine is somebody people have on their show usually and I've had her on the show to talk about the Gnostic Gospels, the Gospel of Thomas, the Nag Hammadi scriptures, like that's her wheelhouse, right? And we touch on some of those things here because her work intersects with her grief, and you'll hear about that. But this is a very different side of Elaine, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have her back on the show for this series that's not a series, talking about grief, because I felt like she would have some really good things to say, and she did. So I hope that this episode is encouraging to you. Next week, just to give you an idea of where we're going here, we have Jonathan Foster coming on the show. He wrote a book called Indigo, which is a book of like poems about grief. A few years back, I think it was maybe 3, 4. I don't remember the exact amount of years. But he talks about it in the episode. His daughter passed away in a car accident, and so we talk about more things, grief. Then the next week we have Perdita Finn coming on the show. Perdita Finn talks to us about working with our ancestors. In what ways are they still here? Are they trying to speak to us and help us and walk with us and guide us? What kind of guidance do they have to offer? How can we communicate with them? Her whole work revolves around that topic, and she brings some amazing perspective. But again, we talk about loss and grief, and I share about my dad. And then April 1st, we have David Giles coming on. You know the Giles name because Keith has been on the show before. That's his dad. But David wrote a novel, and there's some big themes in there, one of them being grief. And so we touch on some different things revolving around grief. And that conversation was the first of this bunch that was recorded. And the first one that I really shared some stuff about my dad, and I was so nervous. I remember I was feeling like, not nervous, but just like I don't, you know, sometimes I think through things I want to say, like to a guest, like I know what they wrote, right? So I want to speak about this and this, and I want to touch on that. And so I'll have like some kind of a pieces of a puzzle in my head. And then as the conversation might go in a different way, I have different pieces I can, you know, pull from. With this, I just didn't even know what I was going to say, you know? So I felt like, I said to David afterwards, I felt like I was just mumbling and stumbling over my words. I said, but this is the first real moment that I've shared some stuff on the podcast in a conversation, not like in a solo kind of way, like me just with the microphone. And so anyway, those are the episodes that are lined up over the next few weeks. And then after that, I don't know why I'm giving you the the lay of the land here, but then after that, we go into some conversations in April and May. And then June is actually obviously Pride. And so we have some conversations on the schedule revolving around Pride. We have my friend Leo from Conversations Official coming on. Leo did a podcast takeover for me last summer after my dad passed away, and shared some solo episodes, so they'll be coming on to talk to me about some different things. Amber Cantorna, her last name now is Wild, but she'll be coming on the show as well to talk about some things. And then my friend Seth Showalter, who published a new book with Choir, he's coming on to talk about some things. So some good conversations in June, and then July and August, I think I'm going to lay low. You know, maybe just go off the podcast radar for a bit. I have so many episodes. Again, I have so many episodes recorded because I had that backlog of episodes when my dad passed away. I kind of got caught up, but as I was getting caught up, like people were emailing me saying, hey, I'd love to come on your show. And they're all great conversations. I'm like, yeah, I'd love to talk to you. And now I just got this backlog again of episodes, and we did that series for New Year where I released like 9 episodes in a row over 9 days. and still not all the way caught up because I have so many great conversations with great people. But I think I might lay low July and August, or maybe just August. I haven't decided yet. And just go off the radar for a bit and spend some time with my daughter, who's obviously going to be out of school. I've been doing a lot of painting and drawing. If you're following me on social media, you see some things there. So dabble with some of those things and some paints and canvas and all that kind of stuff over the summer. But anyway, I don't know. I haven't decided yet what the plan is going to be. But yeah, so those are conversations. Oh, and a big thing in June, I think it's June, the 300th episode. The 300th episode of the show will be dropping. Crazy. 300 episodes. And that's going to be with Brian McLaren. He has agreed to join me for the 300th episode. He has a new book coming out. So we're going to talk about that and reminisce a bit, because Brian is somebody who has been around since the What If Project was just an idea. It wasn't even a recording or anything yet. And he has been a huge encouragement to me. So he'll be coming on. We'll reminisce a little bit and talk about life and all those kind of things. So anyway, my friends, that was a long introduction. But you are in for a treat today with Elaine Pagels. The links to her books are in the show notes. Link to Patreon if you want to support the show. Links to my books as well. But all that to say, my friends, episode 287 with the one and the only, my friend and yours, Elaine Pagels. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome back to the podcast. Today we have on the show one of my favorite people on earth, the one and the only Elaine Pagels. So Elaine, welcome back. I think this is your third or fourth visit, but it's always a pleasure.
Thank you. I'm happy to see you, Glenn.
Thank you. So usually when people have you on the podcast or their podcast, it's because they want to talk to you about any number of things that are right up your alley, the Nag Hammadi scriptures, the Gnostic Gospels, the Gospel of Thomas, you know, any number of books that you have written about the Bible and those ancient texts. But you've also written a book, I think it was your last book that you wrote, Why Religion, which is your memoir. And you share in the story in the book, you do so in a way where at the same time you tell your story, but you also address these questions like, why is religion still here in our modern times? Like, what makes it stick, along with these really big topics like unimaginable loss and grief, yeah, and, you know, moving away from evangelicalism. The book is packed with so many things. So to kind of set up our conversation, I wanted to have you on the show today to ask you if you could share a little bit about this book and a little bit about specifically the loss and the heartache that's captured in the book. Because as you know, our listeners know, my father passed away in March. And so these topics of loss and grief and faith and how it all mixes together has really been on my mind over these last 11 months or so. And there's even days like, you know, a year later, I'm sure you can speak to this, where the grief feels so heavy and it feels so consuming that, like, I don't want to get out of bed. I don't know if I want to believe in God anymore. Like, I just want everybody and everything. I want everything to go quiet for a little while so I could just get off the hamster wheel and just rest. And so all that being said, I'm going to hand the microphone over to you. Obviously, don't want you to share your whole story. People can go and get the book. They can read all about it. Yeah. But can you begin by taking us into the loss, the heartache described in these pages that you've encountered in your life, and maybe some of the things that you learned from those times and how it all intersects with your work? Because what I love about the book is that you talk about how the grief impacted your work, but at the same time, how the work that you do in the world impacted your grief. So wherever you want to go, Elaine, I will follow.
That's a lot to talk about.
A lot.
You know, Glenn, that's a book I never thought I would write. Mm. I only wrote it out of necessity.
Did it help you
because
process?
I was trying to deal with things that I could not deal with. When people write about grief right after it happens, and I mean within years, I don't get it. Because in my case, it was a matter of, the death of our 6-year-old son, beautiful child of a very, very rare disease. My husband and I were told that this marvelous child was not going to live long. And when he was two, we heard this. So we lived with that knowledge. But dealing with the loss of a child is unimaginable. But dealing with any loss can be. And at that time, as I wrote, I mean, I didn't believe in anything. I just thought, I don't care what I believe. I don't need, when people talked about theology and religion, and I wrote this, it was like hearing sounds from the top of the ocean if you're way down in the bottom of the sea. And they just, there's sounds there, but they didn't connect with me. And I thought, I don't care what I believe. I don't know if I believe anything. So I was asking, what is it about the work I do that matters? And I found certain elements of some of the Gospels, and these are the Gospels of the New Testament, about relationships, about how we treat relationships, about what Jesus says about how that works. I thought that matters to me. That matters. There's something there that's powerful. And also, as you know, after our son's death, we had adopted a daughter who was 9 months old when Mark was died at the age of six. And then a year after his death, I dared ask my husband whether he would consider adopting another child, because we tried to have more children, but didn't happen then. So we adopted a second child that was 3 months old. And that was powerful, because it what we couldn't give to this child that we loved, I just felt we had to give it to some child, and then suddenly my husband, who was always hiking out in the mountains, he was a physicist who was just in love with the natural world, went out for what for his hike. Usually it was Wednesday and Saturday. He'd go out in the mountains hiking every for 22 years that we were married. We lived in the wilderness in the summer, where the physicists would always meet near the mountains because they love the outdoors and they love hiking. And he went out one morning and he fell, and he never came back. He fell down probably 1,000 feet while taking one of his graduate students on a path on one of the mountains, one of the 14ers. And my life just shattered. I mean, that's when everything fell apart. Because I not only didn't have a child, I didn't have the husband that I adored. My parents, in my case, were not helpful. They were in California. They never came. They just kind of didn't want to be around that. They don't deal with those things well. So I did have wonderful friends, which helps, of course. But how do you get through that? It was overwhelming. And one of the ways I dealt with it was by not looking at it so far as I could. I had to put one foot in front of the other and get kids out of bed in the morning and find a pair of socks and make a lunch so they could go to school and get myself ready to teach, because now I had no other support at all except my own salary.
Mm.
So I had to keep going, and that was probably helpful in its way.
Mm.
But the other thing was, it was like a black hole in space. I just tried to keep it away and focus. If I walked into my class, I felt I could focus there. If I'm dealing with a 3-month-old baby and a 1-year-old, well, that keeps you busy.
Yeah, right.
And you don't have a lot of time to think before you fall into bed exhausted
Yeah.
after working all day and dealing with 2 kids at night. So it was kind of like a space of my experience that I could not enter, like the Grand Canyon. It was just huge black hole. But then, after you do that for a while, and then, hey, these kids grow up. They go to college. They're out of the house, and I'm there by myself. And I always thought I would have another relationship, but I couldn't even imagine that at the time. So finally, you have to deal with yourself. I found a good Buddhist therapist, and he said, you have to look at it. You have to go back. This is 30 years later. You have to go back there and be there. So I would go to my yoga mat, and I'd end up sobbing. And as you just said, sometimes things that happened a year ago or decades ago can feel like it happened just now. It's right there. And if you allow it to emerge after suppressing it, as I did, that double hit, it comes back in force. But I then started to write, and I never thought I'd publish that book. It wasn't for publication. It was a kind of therapeutic process. But after I'd written it, I thought, there's some embarrassing things in it, which there always are if you tell the truth. And when my students say, oh, I read your book, I think, oh, well, you know more about me than you probably should. But you know what? It doesn't matter much. It's just somebody's story. And like everybody's story, it has things like that in it. But the process, after time, I don't suggest hurrying it. Takes its own time. It can be. One of my friends who was widowed said after a year he thought he was okay. And then after 2 years he realized he wasn't. And so when it was both my husband and my child, it was a long time. But grief takes a much longer time than people tell you. When I was dealing with it, Arthur Kleinemann, who's a psychiatrist at Harvard, came and gave a talk about psychiatry and how it deals with grief. And he said, so the psychiatrists decide that if you're obsessively depressed after 3 months, you've got a problem and you should probably have therapy. If you're seriously disturbed a year later, you have a psychiatric diagnosis. He said, this is totally unreasonable. People knew years ago that it takes a very long time, but he said they diagnose it that way to give themselves more business. Because I think therapy can help, but if you diagnose mourning as an abnormal condition, which it isn't, then it becomes a diagnosis, right?
Keeps you coming back.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't mean that they can't help, which I think they can, but it's very, grief has its own process. And I think the human race has learned how to deal with it because nobody escapes it, right?
Yeah.
So it's like your body and your feelings and your whole being are going through a process that is a suffering.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking while I was in these last 11 months thinking about grief and the loss, and I've realized that like I don't know how to grieve. Like I feel like a life in the church, like I prepared my whole half my life to be a pastor, to be a leader, to do all these different things, to preach. And I did that for a while. And I began to realize that like that life really taught me to suppress my grief so that I could keep going, right? Keep preaching, keep showing up, keep encouraging, keep the smile on my face, and I'll be joyful always. And God will one day wipe away all the tears. And like that was like my mantra. And so many times, like I can remember having like some kind of loss. It wasn't necessarily something like huge, but still something that needed to be grieved. But I pushed the sadness away because like in my mind, it was like, well, as the pastor, you can have an off week, an off couple of weeks, but if that off week is an off month, turns into an off quarter of the year, people start to talk like, what's wrong with the pastor? Like he can't get his act together kind of thing. Maybe this isn't the guy for the job. He's got to be more focused. You got to get the people in the seats. You got to entertain people, keep them coming back. And so I just taught myself to push those feelings away. And then even after the church world, I worked at Apple, an Apple store for 11 years. And at Apple, it's a really great progressive thinking company.
Did you quit being a pastor then?
Yeah, so I left the church, and then I went to get a job at Apple, which is a whole longer story, but I worked there for 11 years. And again, a progressive thinking company, very forward thinking, great benefits, all the different things. But still, like if a parent dies, you get like a week off, and then you come back. Everybody's welcome back. If you need anything, let us know. Yes. But when you hit the sales floor, you've got to have a smile on your face because your smile sells the computer. You got to interact with the people, and you can't be, you have to have that joyful presence out on the floor. So again, in my own losses that I had experienced over my 11 years there, again, I learned to push it away and to put the smile on. And when you get to the end of a 9-hour shift and dealing with literally hundreds of people a day, you're exhausted by the end of the day. So like you said before, you go home, you crash, you go to bed. You get up the next day, you do it again. And so I began to realize after my dad passed away, like, I don't know what to do with all these feelings that I have. But now I'm in this place in my life where I don't have to be on all the time. And I feel like I need to allow myself to feel whatever it is that I'm going to feel. And what I began to realize is, like you said, is that there is no timeline for grief. You can't snap your fingers and say, okay, 6 months from now, it's going to be good to go. But it comes in waves, and it comes when you least expect it. There's days where I think, wow, I'm doing really well. But then the next day, it's like I feel like it just happened again. And I just want to sit down in a puddle of tears. I'm learning I need to listen to my body, listen to my soul, listen to my mind. Like I have to, I've never listened to all these things before. And I'm in this place now where they're all speaking, and I'm trying so hard to listen.
Glenn, the tradition teaches you not to listen.
Yeah.
Especially, it's worse being a pastor, right? Because you have a role.
Yep.
And if you have faith in God, why are you so sad,
Right.
right? I
Exactly.
mean, you have to fake it. And especially, and anybody who's been in that situation, and that's most of us, knows what things people can say.
Yeah.
When the policeman came up to the cabin in Colorado after my husband had gone out hiking that day, and he came to tell me that my husband was dead. This very active, brilliant, marvelous, funny man was dead. He said, "Well, God never gives us more than we can handle." I was so angry. I could not speak. I was standing on a deck with my hands on the handle of the door. and I ripped the door off its hinges with a strength I don't have. I was so angry. Like, how do you know what I can handle? Our child died less than a year ago, and you're telling me God doesn't give, and I have two adopted babies, and our income is down to 30% of what it was when we were doing it together, and I have two adopted babies who need me every minute. Who are you to tell me what I can handle? One of my cousins is a Methodist minister, and his wife had cancer, and she died, and he was heartbroken. And he said people would say, "Well, she's gone to be with Jesus." And he said he felt like saying, "Well, I hope my cat doesn't go to be with Jesus." I mean, it just makes you so angry when people try to say nice, consoling things that are just phrases, and their denial of, they're telling you to deny and please pretend for us that you don't feel that way because you're making us uncomfortable.
Right. Yeah, that's one of the things I really found too is when I never realized before how uncomfortable people are with grief until I was the one carrying it and I was bringing it to people. Like I had a lot of people, don't get me wrong, who were very comforting, who were there for me, but there's a lot of people who I really considered close friends who I realized like they gave their, sorry for your loss, but then it was like I didn't hear from them for months because it was like I don't think people really knew our society and like it's even our church is like we don't prepare people very well for how to deal with their own grief, much less how to help somebody else who's in a grieving situation as well. Because I felt that pressure a lot of times from people like, all right, well, it's been 3 months now. Like, you got to kind of get it together. And I'm like, well, it's 3 months, but like my whole life is different. Like, I don't know. I don't know what to do with this. And like, I just feel like you said, like there's this, you're making me feel uncomfortable. So please let's go back to normal or just pretend to go back to normal at least.
Well, and they say, "Well, I just don't know what to say to him," right? As if saying something to you makes a difference. I mean, there can be things people say,
Sure.
but I think when somebody is in grief, there's a Jewish saying, "Never speak to your friend in the hour of his grief or the hour of his anger." You should be silent. You can come. You can hug the person. You can bring some food. You can sit Shiva the way the Jewish custom, right? Just sit there. People talk, but you don't have to say anything as if anything you say would make a big difference, because mostly it doesn't. That's one thing. But the other thing is, Glenn, and I think it's so important what you're saying. I was in a grew up in a family, as you know, my father had given up what he called ferocious Presbyterianism for Darwin. So all religion was just a bunch of pious lies, as far as he was concerned, and the truth was scientific and rational. The result of that is that death was not talked about. There was no way to deal with it. If somebody died, my parents would say nothing to the children as if we didn't know. They had no way to cope with it themselves. It was basically pretend nothing has happened and just we won't talk about it. My own parents couldn't show up when my son died or when my husband died. That's incomprehensible because I have a daughter who has children. And if something happened to her children, if they were sick, God forbid they should die, right? I'd be there in a flash. But they stayed away. And when I saw them, they didn't want to hear. Don't get upset. Stop. I don't want to hear. So it's that denial of death that some of us have grown up with. That and many people are conditioned to, especially with the loss of traditional religious communities for many people, they just have no clue. And people I know just, they cremate the person, they throw out some ashes, they're done. They don't even have a funeral or a ritual. I'm sure you've seen that. And I think that way of denying it is the worst. But it is very common. And when people have given up a traditional kind of belief, it's acutely a problem. And I think that's what one reason that these traditions speak very powerfully, because they do speak about the mystery of death and the mystery of what's beyond death. We don't know.
That's one of the things. I mean, talking about, like you said, about, not speaking about it to your children and things like that. Like, my daughter is six, and so when before my father passed away, our dog passed away 2 months earlier, and it was her first like real significant loss was her dog, and it was earth shattering for
Mine
her.
too,
And then, 2 months later, her grandfather passes away, and so she's asking like lots of different questions, about life and death and what happens when you die. And I couldn't even imagine like just not answering the question or just like, pushing it back or telling her to stuff it away. Like, we've tried to create this environment where, maybe different than maybe the way that we would have grown up, especially in the church, where she can ask the questions and we have the discussions and we don't feel like we need to have all the answers, because like you said, it's very mysterious. And just to say, I don't know, like, what do you think happened? And then I was able to talk to her about the Gospel of Thomas, about that one line in Thomas where Jesus says that the kingdom of heaven is both within you and without you. And I said, I don't really know what that means, Jordan. Her name is Jordan. I said, but I like to think that that means that that heaven, whatever heaven is, I think that's where we go when we die. I said, I think it's all around us and it's within us. I said, so for me, I said, when I think of those words of Jesus, I like to think that Grandpa is living all around us. But Grandpa's also within us. He's in our memories, he's in our hearts, he's speaking to us. And I said, I think that there's a sense of closeness there. And so she's taken that with her. Like, she's really grasped onto that. And we've been able to have like other talks about like the Buddhist idea, of the ocean and the waves, how once we pass on from this life, we fall back into the ocean of the divine or whatever that might be, and to kind of talk about it that way. But we've been able to have all these mysterious conversations, which I think has been healthy for her, because it's helped her process a lot of her questions, a lot of her grief. And I think at the same time, it's helped me as well, because again, I grew up in that environment where you don't talk about it, you just stuff it away and move on with your life. Like the Energizer Bunny, just keep on going and going and going. And so I feel like that's really forced me to stop and to ponder and to kind of allow those questions to wash over my own soul as I talk to her about them as well.
Well, in my own experience, I mean, I assumed I was a rationalist too for quite a long time. I mean, that's when I went back to graduate school. But what do we know about Christianity? And then I got into mysteries again, because the secret gospels, there's a great deal of power in those stories. And also in my experiences with people who die, they got more complicated, and they are more complicated now than they were, and much more interesting. After my son died, a woman came to see me. She was the wife of the president of Rockefeller University, where my husband had been teaching physics for his whole career, for 20 years. Her husband was a very famous biologist who had a Nobel Prize in biology, Joshua Lederberg. And Marguerite Lederberg was a psychiatrist. And she said to me, "I just want to tell you something that happened to me." So she came and talked to me, and she told me that she had had a burst appendix. And she was taken to the emergency room, and the doctors were working on the burst appendix, because it can kill you if it explodes in you, inside of you, And she said they were working on her, and her appendix burst, and she died. technically. And the stories you hear, she saw her body from up there. She saw them working frantically on her body, and she was doing something, just let it go, stop, just stop. But they kept doing that. And then she said there was a time when she remembers nothing, but because she's telling me the story, she came back to life, and she said it was glorious. Where I was, it was a glorious state. The world here seemed gray to me. I didn't want to come back, but I did. She said they took me back in the body. Shocked her body what some way. And she said, I just want to tell you something else happens. She said, and after that, Marguerite, she's Jewish. She was raised to be Jewish and secular, a scientist, right? A psychiatrist, complete rationalist. After that, she went to Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, which is across the street from Rockefeller University. And she became a psychiatrist for patients with terminal diagnoses because she became convinced that death is quite different than what she imagined, either the process of dying or whether there's something after that. And I don't know whether there is or not, or whether it's the illusion of the dying brain or not, but there's more to it than we knew. And 3 days after my husband died, as you know from the book, I was in shock. I hadn't slept for 3 days. I was a complete wreck. And I went to the monastery in Snowmass, where the Trappist monks had been my mentors, wonderful monks, even though I wasn't a Catholic. And they came to the service for my husband with their in their work clothes. They were dressed in jeans and work shirts and not in their robes as monks, so that people didn't know they were the monks. I knew they were the monks. They were sitting in this little Episcopal church. I'd never seen them outside of their monastery. I thought, whoa, okay, there they were. And anyway, 3 days after his death, I went to plan the funeral at the Episcopal church, and then I went up to the chapel where the monks meditated and prayed, and I sat with one whose name was Theophane, whose name means God manifest, Theophanes, a beautiful monk with long beard and very funny and very playful, with a beautiful spirit. I love this man. And he sat with me for about an hour, and we meditated alone, with a candle that they used when someone had died. And at that point, I finally got quiet, and I felt, without thinking, as though I could ask my husband, well, how do you feel about this? So I sort of, in my mind, I sort of, well, how do you feel about this? I didn't say it out loud. And just like that, it's like a voice came into my head saying, this is fine with me. It's you I'm concerned about now. And I said, what do you mean fine with you? You leave me with two babies and it's fine with you? Are you out of your mind? And then I thought, wait a minute. I don't think that's my unconscious speaking. Because it wasn't fine with me. It's not fine with me today that that happened. That was very traumatic and very hard on my children. And it ch transformed my life in difficult ways. So it's not fine with me now. Certainly wasn't then, but it wasn't. I thought, damn it, he would have said that. He might have said that. He was just complicated and remarkable enough to have said that. And so I don't know what happened. Was it he speaking to me? But it certainly didn't feel like me. And other things happen that are quite mysterious. So I'm not at all, I'm an agnostic in a way, because I don't know. But I certainly don't exclude the possibility that something else happens that we just don't have any consciousness of in the situation which we are now for the most part.
That's right. Yeah, I mean that's where I am too. Like I feel like I don't know for sure, but I have to let myself hope that there's something there. You know, there has to in my mind, like in my heart of hearts, I feel like there has to be something good that happens on the other side of the veil, so to speak. And I mean, even like it was maybe like 3, 4 months after he passed away, we were walking down the street as a family, like after dinner one night. And my daughter was riding her bike, I think, and I had a like a travel mug of coffee, and you know, we're walking with my wife, and my dad loved butterflies, and this butterfly, Elaine, I kid you not, this butterfly came, and he also loved his coffee too. This butterfly came and sat on the rim of the coffee cup, and its little antennas were going into like the little puddle of coffee that was there, and it would not move, and I literally touched its wing. And then it flew away and it came and rested on my shoulder. And as we were walking, like it was there. And then it went on my daughter's bike. She's like, "Look, Daddy, the butterfly's on my bike handle." And she's like, "Grandpa loved butterflies." So maybe that's Grandpa. And so we had this like this moment where we felt like this has to be something there. And there's even times like at school, she'll be out for recess. She's like, "Daddy, I saw a butterfly came over and flew by me today. I think Grandpa was there with me while I was playing with my friend, you know." And it's like I feel like there has to be something. But to your point, like I feel like I've had so many meaningful interactions with my father post his passing, even maybe more so than I had, you know, pre his passing in those difficult months leading up to it. I feel like there's been so many meaningful moments that have happened, and I have to believe that that's because there's something good on the other side of the veil.
So if you play the rationalist card, you just ignore all that stuff.
That's right.
But I know they happen.
Yep.
I know of a funeral of a mother in which a bird came and circled the head of her little girl in the middle of the service in through the window. I mean, and often it happens with birds and with creatures.
Yep.
I've heard this from other people as well. And like you, I think, well, when I die, I'm going to hope that Mark and Heinz will be there. You know? I just talked to someone whose mother died and he's a psychiatrist. I love this man. He's a psychiatrist at New York University, and his practice is dealing with hospice patients. And his mother died last week. And he said before she did, the nurse told him that she said, "Oh, let him in." And the nurse said, "Who?" And she named her husband who had died long before. She said, "Yes, let him in now." So he was waiting at the door, she felt. And this happens a lot. I mean,
Wow.
are these just illusions that we do to soften the harsh blow of nothing happens and you're just totally extinct? I'm not convinced of that anymore. I mean, the life we have is so mysterious, and things have been happening to me that are quite amazing, I can tell you.
Right.
Amazing indeed.
So what do you know, the title of your book, Elaine, is Why Religion? And this is the big question I wanted to ask you. And like why what you talked before we hit record about a friend who, you know, would ask you like, why are you still a Christian? Why do you still hold on to your faith? Like, look at all the things that have happened to you, and you've only described a small, I mean, it's a small segment of your life. There's a whole lot of other things revolving around these stories that are in your book, but like all the things that have happened to you, why religion? Why Christianity? Why do you still follow the way of Jesus, the way of Christ? Why do you still identify in that? Because I think of a lot of people who listen to the show have told me, as I've been vulnerable with my own losses, about their losses, you know, maybe the loss of a spouse, a child, like you said, you know, maybe loss of a marriage, Maybe the loss of a home. One person had a fire in their home. Everything is gone, you know, and they say, why? Why believe in this God? Why hold on to my faith? Like, what is the point of it all? So if somebody like that was on the microphone today, what would be your response to that?
Well, there are people who, the person who said that to me had decided that his faith was just some kind of a prop. And I thought, so what do you imagine? You're imagining that God sort of points a finger and says, I'm going to punish this person and have this person die. I mean, what does that have to do with it? The reason I explore and went back to the study of religion is that this is the region of experience from which a great deal of poetry and music and ritual and meditation have become traditions for thousands of years. Whether you're a Buddhist, it wouldn't have to be a Christian tradition for me, although much as I like certain elements of Buddhism, other parts of it are to me very foreign. The Christian story to me is like home. I grew up in it, and there are elements of it that I love, and there are elements that I don't believe, but that's okay. Because what it does, I've been reading the gospel stories for the book I'm writing now, and they have a typical pattern, Glenn, a pattern you'll recognize. They start in the world you are in, and I'm in. With sickness, with death, with suffering, with paralysis, with mental illness, with loss. And the story will move into hope. The blind man sees, the lame starts to walk, the dead get up. And the worst things happen. Nothing worse happens than what happens to Jesus in Mark. And he's abandoned by everyone he knows. He's arrested on false charges. He's tortured and he's abandoned and killed by his enemies in a horrible way. And then he's buried and the tomb is empty. I mean, it's an awful story. And the ending, as you know, is that the women run away from the grave in terror because they don't know what happened. It's a terrible story. But it can only be good news if Mark has a sense that there's something beyond what they can see. And that's what I felt, that something mysterious goes on, that somehow my husband and my relationship with him is not over completely. But I would say, but I want him here. I want him right here physically, right? I didn't get that. But it's still, there's something that mysterious that happens in the way we relate to people who are here and people who have died. Because I don't know where they are, but I kind of know that they're not simply gone. And the religious traditions are the traditions that speak about those qualities of experience that you're talking about, which lend us hope. And you can't live without that. One of the secret gospels that I love best, it's not a gospel, it's the revelation of Zostrianos, attributed to a young Jewish man who says he's so disturbed and depressed, confused with everything. His life means nothing. He decides to kill himself. Do you know the text? He goes into the desert to kill himself. And he says, suddenly, just as I was about to do it, I saw a light and I heard a voice that said, Zostrianos, have you gone mad? And he said, then he was taken up into some kind of light. And when he sort of came back to where he was before, he says a line that I think is so amazing. He said, then I saw that the light in me was greater than the darkness because it contained the whole light. And he's changed. And it's only these kinds of traditions that speak about what I call experiences I cannot explain.
Yeah.
And there are lots of them. They're mysteries. I don't think it has to be Christianity. But as I say, for me, that's like English to me. That's like America to me. That's my home territory.
Yeah.
A lot of my friends go into Buddhism and other traditions, which I have too, to some extent, and I kind of get it. But it's easier for me to. This morning I was at Trinity Church, Princeton Episcopal Church. The music was extraordinary. Contemporary music written on ancient psalms. And the whole place was alive with some kind of energy. Very powerful. What is that about?
Yeah.
It's something I need. Some people don't. They don't have a taste for it.
Yep.
What? You know? And I think, well, from my point of view, it's like you live in a flat earth with a ceiling on top, and there's nothing, there's no angels dancing around or
Right.
mysteries up there that or down there or wherever,
Yeah.
or right on your coffee cup.
Yeah.
You don't see them.
Yeah. Barbara Brown Taylor talks about how she has a book, it's called Holy Envy, which talks about how she was a professor of world religions. And so she would talk to her students about all these different religions, but she grew up, in the Christian faith. And she said, I learned to appreciate so many other religions. I have little tents set up in Buddhism and Islam and all these other places, but my home, I always come back to Christ at night, she said, because Christ is my home. Christianity is my home, so I come back to that. And I feel like that's kind of where I've been at, like on this journey, is that like when people ask me that question, I think that like, why are you still a Christian? Why do you, and the losses that you've had in your life, things you've experienced, like why do you still believe? And I feel like it's easier for me nowadays in the way that I view the Bible as opposed to the way that I used to view the Bible. Like I used to view the Bible as this inerrant, perfect word of God, and I feel like that doesn't hold up anymore in this place where I'm at now, right? So nowadays, like I see the Bible as this collection of these stories that people wrote, trying to figure out like how do you walk through this very real life where you experience loss and you experience death and you experience grief and you experience unimaginable things happening. How do you walk through that with a very invisible God? Like, what does that even look like? And I feel like all these gospel writers and the secret gospels, like they're all trying to sort out these ideas and these feelings. And I haven't told anybody this, but I'm gonna tell you, and I'll make it public now. But I felt like a few months ago, like I was thinking about that, and I felt like the spirit or whatever you want to say it was, said to me that we're writing your own secret gospel right now. Like your life that you're living, and you're trying so hard to sort out what it looks like to walk with me, to walk with the divine. Like this is your life is its own secret gospel. Like you're sorting, you're taking your stand in a long line of people that have come before you trying to figure this out. Newsflash, you're not going to figure it out, but you're going to add some more language and some more things to the conversation that might help somebody else down the road.
Well, Glenn, I was reading this morning about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I don't think they were recognized as sacred writings until the second century when Irenaeus insisted that they were clues to the gospel, which was the message of hope. And you put your finger on it. When I wrote Beyond Belief, it's because at the point after my son died and my husband died, I didn't know or care what I believed. As I said, I just thought, I don't believe anything. In a way, I don't know. I'm just. But it's not for me about belief. It's about experience. That's the second word you used. You were experiencing things that happened to you and your daughter, and that is what I care about. That even at my son's funeral, it was. I don't have to tell you. I can't even imagine what kind of day it was. But there it was. And my husband and I were standing in the back of the church with a little coffin. And I didn't want to be there. I wanted to be anywhere else. I wanted to be out of this world. I just wanted to be out of the world because it was just too painful.
Yeah.
And then I had this sense. It was like a vision, but it wasn't a real vision. It wasn't something I saw. I felt that there was a huge net over this huge scene of people at the back of the church. And it was like there was a net with enormous cables for the ropes. And between the spaces in the net were spaces maybe 6 to 4 feet wide. And that you could be just ripped out of the world at any moment. And I wanted to get out of there because there were these people and there was my son's coffin, right? And then I had a sense that it was only the relationships, the knots in the net that kept me in the world. There was my husband was there. My close friend was there holding the baby we had adopted. People from all over our lives were there. And it was those relationships that were holding us in the world. And this is not a belief. That was an experience. So I want to say, what I believe goes up and down. It doesn't matter as much. What I experience, and that's the quality that William James talks about in the Varieties of Religious Experience. When he writes, and you know the book, right? He writes against Freud, religion is not an illusion. Because it comes out not out of belief in fake things and wishful thinking. It's not just an illusion. It is comings out of experience. And he wrote about people who had experiences. I call them experiences I can't explain. There are lots of them. And you've had some. So if you tune into that kind of experience with sensitivity, it opens up a different quality of reality. And that's what I say, that kind of happened to me. It had happened before, but I didn't pay much attention to it until it got very close and practically, well, it shattered my life.
Well, Lane, we are just about out of time, but this has been wonderful. I appreciate you coming on to talk to us about your story, and I appreciate your friendship. You were one of the first people I reached out to when everything happened with my father, and I knew that you would have a friendly word and that you would understand kind of where I was coming from. And I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today and to share your story, and again for your work.
Well, Glenn, I'm really enjoying our conversation, and I'm hoping that sometime, and it doesn't have to be within the next 10 years, that you will write or even now start making notes about your secret gospel. Because, as you say, the accumulation of those contributions really offer paths to other people as well.
That's right. Our experiences can inform and speak to the experiences of others, right?
Yes.